money or money alone. It's about these elements of microeconomics that concerns attitudes, interests, motives, and so on and so on. So I am going to start with the short statement and review of these bad incentives cause bad security. And then we'll have an overview of different kinds of bad incentives that lead to bad security, so as to illustrate the problems with small models. There you see five examples. Some of them, these two, are actually given to you as possible project. So in reality, I will only speak a little bit about network externalities and asymmetric information, and keep the slides that show some archetypes for later. So after Friday the 9th, I will publish archetypes for networks externalities and for asymmetric information affecting security. Then, out of the fact that misaligned incentives create bad security, there have been studies proposing legal measures so as to compel actors to align their incentives with good security. We will see a little bit of them and comment how effective they are. And then propose, as a complement, enlightenment using system dynamics model to show that people who misalign incentives towards security may pay a high price in the long run. And I will sum up the results of these studies at the end. So there is a famous article that was published in 2006 in one of the most prestigious journals of the world. It appeared in Science and Nature. They are the journals where you will get immediate international reputation if you got a paper accepted in one of these journals. And in this article that appeared in 2006 and was co-authored by Ross Anderson from University of Cambridge in the UK and Tyler Moore, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, it started by stating that over the past 6 years, people have realized that security failure is caused at least as often by bad incentives as by bad design. This is a very strong statement. And this statement is today more true than ever. And that has, in principle and a simple reason, is that is when the principal, the person or the institution that is supposed to guard the systems is not the person who suffers most when the systems are compromised or fail, then this leads to bad security. So among the things that they would like to illustrate and that needs to be even better explored is which kind of misaligned incentives exist and how do they cause security failures and how could we implement proper incentives. By the way, the article by Anderson and Moore is uploaded to Blackboard. So here are the five examples or cases that I would like to illustrate. Three of them in detail. The other two, these two, they are actually proposed as examination project, but I will later also add to these slides the corresponding models. Let's start with the first example, which was in fact the one that launched this discipline called the economics of information security, because it is a discipline. And there are people working solely with that, and you have conferences dedicated only to that, and you have journals publishing articles on that issue. So when automatic telling machines were introduced, that's what we call mini-banks in Norway, when they were introduced in Europe, if a customer found a transaction that he or she didn't agree and claimed towards the bank, then he or she had to prove that he hadn't done it. But how could you? How could you prove that? So assume you get your monthly sheet and you see there, oh, somebody has taken money off my account. I wasn't. So how do you prove it? You were not. So you would believe the banks had a very nice situation. But ultimately what happened is there was so much fraud, not caused by bad security, by crooks exploiting the weaknesses of their automatic telling machines, that it was a big scandal in the United Kingdom. It happened also in the Netherlands, to some extent also in Norway. Also in the end, the banks had to compensate their customers and they had to improve the security of the automatic telling machines, so the ATMs. But that was very costly. First, compensating was costly because there was a lot of fraud. And second, bad reputation, losing image, losing face and so on, all were bad things for the banks. And then if you have started by creating or establishing or implementing ATMs that had bad security, it's very bad, very difficult and very costly to improve them later. William asks if there was a drop in use. I haven't seen any statistics as to that, but I could imagine that this was in addition one of the elements that forced the banks to improve security, because after all they were installing the ATMs because they wanted to reduce their costs. But if they turn out that many customers who use them had to be got problems because the security was bad, and they were abused by others, and they had problems in getting the money back, that must have indeed reduced the attractiveness of the ATMs. I haven't seen the statistics, perhaps probably they are. I guess that was a factor that made the banks turn around. Now let's look now at an archetype that expresses the problem archetype. So if the bank's action is to push the burden of proof on customers, they expect this to reduce fraudulent transactions, saying if some among my customers are trying to cheat and they later say, hey, I wasn't me, please give me the 3,000 crowns back or pounds or whatever, and the bank says, prove it. And you know you cannot prove, it's very difficult, especially if it was you were cheating. So they were expecting this to reduce fraudulent transactions, and by keeping this pressure high, they in making the customer liable, they expected to reduce fraud. But the unintended consequence of that was that the banks were complacent, because if something happens, it is up to the customer to prove that he or she didn't do that. That's so difficult. So you don't need to care about security because it's the customer's problem, it's not yours. So that leads to decreasing the ATM security. And decreasing the ATM security, of course, was an incitement for crooks, for dishonest people, not the clients, because they wouldn't have a gain if they wouldn't get the money back. But all the crooks that saw that the mini banks were insecure, they used that for fraud. So you got a reinforcing loop the ATM fraud epidemic. By more proof from the customers, the more the banks were complacent, less interested, and less motivated. This diminishes the security. This increased fraudulent transactions. And since the banks thought that their solution was to increase the burden of proof, they did even more of that. And this only reinforced the fraud epidemic. They didn't see this consequence, or they didn't want to see that. That's the boundary. Okay? So, the banks were ultimately forced, when they saw the consequences, the bad consequences, losing face, scandals, losing customers, less use of ATMs, thanks to William for suggesting that, which I think happened. And so they were forced ultimately to spend the vulnerabilities. So this link came here, delayed, and this increased the ATM security. So we call this balancing loop the bank awakes at last. So that was kind of a solution, retrospective solution of the problem. Okay? But now let's look at what happened in the United States. In the United States, you had a different strategy because the law forced U.S. banks to assume the burden of proof. So if some person going to the bank and say, hey, I see this transaction here. I didn't do that. Then it was the bank who was obliged to prove that she didn't do the transaction. In such a situation, of course, the banks were extremely motivated to implement upfront the security to reduce the possibility of this occurring, because they know that they had to prove that it was not the unsecure ATM who was the problem, but it was the customer who was trying to cheat. Okay? So let's look at the problem archetype. So the burden of proof on banks motivates them to spend on security upfront, to be proactive, to reduce fraudulent transactions. And there you have the balancing loop, the bank is liable. Does this have an unintended consequence? Yes, it does, because the bank will normally not spend money in prosecuting small transactions that were cheated. So, of course, ATMs, they are not completely secure. And some people will speculate on that. And they knew, the professionals or the customers, they knew the probability of not being prosecuted, of not the bank not investing resources in investigating the case, increases the smaller the fraud is. So there will be people, both customers and crooks, betting on the bank accepting the loss if it was sufficiently small. But this will, of course, lead more and more to fraud schemes, more and more possibilities. So even if you didn't make much money from each attempt to cheat, you could, by having many different schemes, create many different transactions, and so on and so on. So the ultimate consequence, there will be a reinforcing loop, betting on the bank on accepting the loss so that the losses went under the radar shield. But the bank would maintain and keep the security high. They were motivated to that. So the solution loop will be to improve the security all the time to beat the crooks. Now, what you notice is that we have, in the previous case, we had a so-called out-of-control loop. We do have, in the new case, an out-of-control loop. But it doesn't mean that both have the same impact. Because the main difference is, in the European case, security is implemented in the end as a solution in a reactive way after the problems escalate. Whereas in the US case, you implement security in advance. You do have some minor unintended consequences because the crooks speculate on the bank accepting minor losses without investing resources in investigating them. But it's a much more effective and less costly strategy. Indeed, Because the book looks only capitalizing a small front, that wasn't, the losses were not so big, and by spending on continuous security improvement, the losses were kept at acceptable limits. And we have the empirical results. The security of ATMs in the U.S. was much higher, and it was cheaper to maintain, to introduce and maintain than it was in Europe. So what do we learn from this? What we do learn is that the misaligned incentives that prompted the European banks to push the responsibility, the burden of proof on the customer, it was only of some advantage temporarily to begin with and resulted over a long time with delayed effects, see again the issue of time delays, in major losses. Whereas the aligned incentives that the banks to begin with considered to be a disadvantage turn out to be an advantage. And here I think that's a very interesting opportunity for system dynamics models by looking at the unintended consequences to educate those who are responsible for security to carefully consider incentives. Because which may look profitable on short side could turn out to be unprofitable on long term. I will come back to this with a system dynamics model that we can simulate. Network externalities effects. That's an issue that I define as a project. But here I will release a slide with archetypes, input is here, and upload it. So, an externality is a term used in microeconomics to define something that hits you, that affects you, but where you don't have control. It is not you who has released that. For instance, an externality is a company that is polluting the environment. They are producing something, and in order to reduce the cost, they simply let the polluted air go out unclean, as it was historically done for nearly 200 years, and today is still done in some countries or in some branches, far too high an effect, or pollute waters and whatever. So all this is affecting you. Somebody else is having benefits, and you are getting paying for that. So it is an advantage for software producers to go to the market to sell the products as quick as possible. Because by doing that, they catch customers, and if the customer invests in using and learning the software, then the probability that this customer later will change for a better product that comes later is small. So there is a saying, which probably is fictitious, that Bill Gates says, let's release the software now and then we fix the problems in the next version. But the company is not trying to reduce the effect. No, the company... if a company is making profit by producing something, and in producing that, this is polluting the air, the environment, and so on and so on. So you outside of the company are suffering from the externality. That is something external to you that you cannot influence, but it's affecting you. It is the company's decision who is benefiting by not cleaning, they are reducing the costs. They are making profits from the products, but the costs, they fall upon you because you are inhaling, you are having the bad air, and so on and so on. In a sense, people who are driving cars, to decide on the archetype, you need that. Yes, and when you derive this archetype, you have to consider the company's viewpoint, which is the intended consequence, and look at the externality as unintended consequence. Okay? That much about this. More I cannot say because that is an examination project. Okay? Asymmetric information. Again, part of the examination project. There was an article by an economist, Akerlof, that over many years later, led to his getting the Swedish Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences. Interestingly, the article by Akerlof was rejected by many journals. They didn't understand the importance of that, or they say, oh, we know that, and so on. So they rejected the paper, and it was published after many attempts, I think 6 or 7 attempts. And ultimately, it turned out to be very innovative, and it led to an avalanche of work and interesting things that are very important. So what is asymmetric information? Akerlof illustrated that with the market of lemons. William, correct me if I am wrong. I think lemons is slang in the United States for used cars. So it's the market of used cars. So William confirms that. Very good. So suppose you are going to buy a used car. So you go to a retailer there, and he shows you 2 cars, and they look quite, for you, quite equal. And the one costs $2,000, and the other one $1,000. You don't see the difference, and then you will choose the one for $1,000. But the seller knows why the price difference is, because the seller knows exactly the quality of the car. He's an expert, or she's an expert, and so on and so on. So what happens is the expensive used cars will not be easily sold at the price that will profitable for the seller, because of the asymmetric situation where the seller knows much more than the customer knows. In such a situation, then high quality products will be driven out of the market, because nobody will, or few people will like to sell a good car only for $1,000. So this can be translated to many other domains, and such a domain is about security. Because the problem with secure products is that a lot of the customers, they don't know about security products, or they don't care so much about secure products, as we will see in the next archetype, which is about the tragedy of the commons. So in a situation where somebody claims this product is the best, it's secure and so on, but the customers cannot assess that, or maybe don't care so much about security, this will lead to less demand to the more costly products that have higher quality, because higher security is higher quality. So developing higher security, having higher quality will be something that is difficult to do. William asked if the seller could use this information to convince the customer. Well, it depends on a lot of things. It depends on the, first of all, how good the seller is able to communicate and show the differences. It concerns also how well the customer knows about the technicalities, about the proofs that can be given. Can you show the proofs and so on? It depends also on the motivation of the customer. In the case of security, one of the problems is not only lack of knowledge, it's also lack of interest about security, because very often people don't understand the damages of security, they are not able to assess them, or in many cases, security will not hit them, but security will not hit them so directly. So we have a lot of issues there as to how to improve the situation, especially in the case of security. And imagine in the case of buying products, suppose you are considering 2 simulation tools, and you look at the web pages, and look at PowerSim, look at Vensim, and so on. Do you see much about information about security? No. And probably they are differing in the security quality. Why is there not so much information there? Because the demand from the customers is not so great. How many ask yourself how many times when you consider buying some software, you have done a security check of the software. Even if you are concerned about security. It takes time, it concerns a lot of aspects, and even myself as a professor in security, I think I will have a tough job in assessing the security of products because it has so many aspects to that. So part of the issue and challenges of future security is how to improve the understanding of security, how to communicate it better, how to measure it better, metrics again, how to make it easier for the public to obtain metrics, understand the metrics about security, which again is an argument for the importance of this course. Then, tragedy of the commons. Tragedy of the commons is a very famous problem that originated in the areas of common pastures. So, already since the Middle Ages and perhaps before, there were pastures in different countries, especially in England, where they were common property. So the people belonging to that common, say there was a little village and so on, they could put their sheep or their cows on the common for grazing. And there were gentlemen agreements, Berit should forget me or the other ladies for using the term gentleman agreement, but that's a standing term. Something you trust each other, that you say, okay, we agree, we won't only have so many sheep grazing, and so on. Now, what happened in practice is that people cheated, because suppose they had agreed only 10 sheep in the big commons, they were just released, and they were grazing free and spreading around. And they had, of course, a mark so that people know to whom they were. But they put 12. Huh? Nobody could easily check that there were 12 there because it was a big area and they were moving. How would you count sheep, especially if they were mixed with sheep with other ones and so on? An impossible problem. So the logic was adding more sheep adds to my benefits. Yes, that may lead to more sheep, of course, will graze a bit more, and that will deteriorate the pasture and so on. But this is happening perhaps in 30, 40 years. Then I am dead. In the meantime, I earn more money and so on. But of course, this was a logic that everybody applied. And because of that, it was experienced time and again, that the commons were overexploited, overgrazed, and eroded away. Solutions were established. They are fascinating studies, and in fact, a lady, and I forgot her name, got a Nobel Prize in Economics for her studies on well-managed and less well-managed commons. There are examples of well-managed commons in different areas of the world, and she compiled the principles for well-management of commons. But let's look at the problem with security. Let's increase this. So consider the individual's investment in security. The less you invest, the more you save. After all, the security in the internet, that's something that is collective. So how much worse becomes the internet if you don't spend in security? A tiny bit less. But you reap the benefits of not investing in security. Your computer is unsecured and so on. It doesn't matter. My network is unsecured. Anything, something happens, it will hit others. So, again, by only caring about myself, and everybody will do that, then the consequences accumulate. And the unintended consequence of this egoistic attitude is that the more I save, it should be here minus. The more I save, the less the internet security, and the less the system security, here should be plus, the more I save and so on. More I save, the less internet security, the less internet security, plus signs, the less I will save again, because in the end it will be it will contrast that. So there will be a long-term damage to overall security, and the savings that I get short-term by not spending in security will in the long-term lead to the opposite, to cost. But if the delays are very, very, very big, then few people care about that. So what we see here is that I will correct the polarities here. Against, I am proving that even experts can make often mistakes. What saves us is the ability to recognize the mistakes and correct them. A great scientist said in the last century that progress in science was facilitated by making the necessary errors as quickly as possible, and of course by correcting them. So we have an underachievement archetype, where the idea is to maximize one's benefits, each individual, by saving on security, letting others spend. But since everybody does the same, then you get an unintended consequence of overbalancing feedback, which is driving security downward, and then ultimately will hit everybody over a long time by bad security and the associated in the costs that will accrue. We don't have good solutions to the tragedy of commons and security, because, of course, it's very, very difficult to control. One of the keys of well managing the commons is being able to enforce the rules. And this you could do, for instance, in pastures in some way by having some vigilance and so on. And similarly, in other commons that exist, for instance, in Spain, there were common usage of water reservoirs where you had some controls for how many people use and so on. But also another control of only authorized people to use the commons. The internet is in this case the commons, but you don't have any way to control who enters the internet. Anybody can enter and anybody can misbehave. So we have a very big, big, big problem connected to the tragedy of the commons and internet, and we don't have good solutions yet. The only good solution that I could see is increasing the education and visualizing the long-term cost for everybody, hoping that more and more people would then have insights, and then perhaps also establishing some systems for penalizing bad security and so on. But that's long, long, long term. We don't have any working solution now. Then the odds on the black hackers. You know the difference between black and white hackers. Black hackers try to find vulnerabilities to exploit them for their own benefits, be it their own attacks to gain access to information or for fraud or whatever, or be to sell the vulnerabilities, if they are zero-day vulnerabilities, for others to use for spam, for attacks, whatever. White hackers are those who are trying to hack the system to discover the vulnerabilities so as to get them patched and removed before they are discovered by black hackers. But what is the problem? The problem is that software is still of very bad quality. We know there are millions of vulnerabilities in Windows, in other operating systems and software and so on. There are really millions. So there are many of these vulnerabilities. They are potentially very serious. Now, as a white hacker, you are trying to discover vulnerabilities, and the black hackers are trying to discover them. What is the chance that you anticipate the black hackers' discovery of some serious vulnerability? This is very low, because there are so many vulnerabilities that need to be discovered and patched. There are so many black hackers who are looking for these vulnerabilities. The probability that you hit on a vulnerability and remove it before others have anticipated is very small. So because we have very insufficient quality assurance in software, in part because the users don't understand and appreciate security, the number of undiscovered software vulnerabilities is huge, and the odds are on the black hackers to be the first to discover them for pernicious uses. So let's look at the archetype. The archetype shows that the higher the software quality assurance, the more secure the software is, but that will decrease the market share because that makes security expensive and people will not pay for security software. So that will then diminish, will be a vicious circle for you. If you are entering the circle of more quality assurance, this will force you to do that at the expense of reducing the market share. So let's assume this, the opposite. You reduce the quality assurance to make your software less secure but cheaper. You increase your market share, which motivates you to even less security assurance. Okay? What is the unintended consequence? This is balancing loop. We call it reinforcing loop. We call it the winner takes it all, first to the market. The unintended consequence is that this is increasing the increasing market share at the expense of security is increasing the attractiveness of targets where the odds are on the black targets. This increases the probability of profitable attacks. And over the long term, this will reduce the market share. So the hope is in this balancing loop that ultimately this attitude will hit back on unscrupulous software providers that don't care about security. I put a question mark because the problem is there are so big delays here, so big delays that unscrupulous software developers, and most of them are quite unscrupulous, they bet on making a lot of profit before they are hit by this. And that has been the problem with many of the commons as well. The reason why commons have been destroyed, including, for instance, fisheries. In Canada, for instance, the Canadians, they increase the fishery of the cod in Newfoundland to such extent that they extinguish it. And that was an incredible, rich, renewable resource if they had managed it well, but they didn't care. The people who invested in making money, they got very, very rich. And those who paid the bill were the employees, the fishers who work in the ships, the customers, the people who like cod and so on, and so on and so on. So the cod was virtually extinguished in Newfoundland. There is a fascinating book by Mark Kurlansky with the title Caught, a Biography of the Fish That Changed the World. A Biography of the Fish That Changed the World. It is a fascinating story that tells the development of cod fisheries in the Norwegian areas, Icelandic waters, Greenland waters, the Basque fishes, ships that were fishing cod and came first to Newfoundland before Columbus came to America and so on. The importance of cod for developing the American nation, for Boston, the trade with cod that was, it was a triangle trip of selling cod to markets into Africa and taking African slaves to America where unscrupulous entrepreneurs were earning on each leg of the journey and so on. And then finally, the advancement in the fisheries that led to the decline in the fisheries, with some exceptions. Hope we still have good fisheries in Norway, thanks to a very good management. But unfortunately, the similar wandering cod in Newfoundland, that like the Lofoten cod, came to the south for laying eggs, and then wandered, will walk and fish in swamps upwards to the north, to Arctic waters, to grow in areas that were very rich in nutrients, and then came back and so on. The Newfoundland cod was extinguished. ISN, what do you mean by that? There is a comment by... is in these Roman steps in in that. Well, I guess that William's question is about who is responsible for the mismanagement. Yes, I guess in the case of Canada, they didn't have the same experience that, say, Norway had in management the fish resources, and perhaps also the fact that Norway was in a position where they had to defend themselves against the interests of the European Union that make them very, very, very restrictive and so on. So I guess the Canadian government failed, but partly also because they didn't understand the problem. Imagine in the book by Kurlansky, sorry, we are speaking about other things as security. Yes. In the book of Kurlansky, he documents that the biologists considered the cod to be, so to speak, unextinguishable. They say it is such a fertile fish that you cannot fish too much. Even biologists believe that. So again, an example of how experts can be very, very, very wrong. Okay, but going back to the issue of security, which is where we are now. So we have a reinforcing feedback driving being first to the market at the expense of security. The winner takes it all. But this creates attractive attack targets and profitable attacks, and will hopefully, over the long term, create problems for those who are, even for them who are putting unsecure software in the market. I think in contrast to, say, the owners of the vessels that we are shipping in the court grounds, Bill Gates and Microsoft and all these companies, they would like to continue making profit. So they will, I think they are becoming more and more aware of these problems, and they are putting more emphasis on security. Also the consequences that we see now in terms of hacking, even government networks, influencing elections and so on and so on, they are making people more and more aware about the importance of security. So perhaps there is hope that governments become more active and regulate this and become more effective. But still, it's a very, very tough problem, and we don't have satisfactory solutions yet. Thanks for all the comments. I see that Rune and William are very active. I enjoy that very much. And some very interesting questions, thought-provoking. Okay. Now, there is an article by Tyler Moore that I have uploaded where he discusses legal measures. So he proposes making involved entities liable for the products and services. So rather than being liable if something happens afterwards, liability should be connected a priori or anticipated in the products that they're delivering. So another issue is information disclosure. Legal measures should stimulate entities to disclose security-related information, ranging from found bugs to aggregated or estimated loss figures. That's a hard issue to convince entities to do that, but again, it could be promoted by law. And here system dynamics could play an interesting role, because system dynamics has been used in litigation in project failures by connecting consequences of decisions to the causes. So if something similar was done related to security measures and indicators and so on, so that one could have kind of a forensic via a systematic model, then that could make such measures more effective. Then another thing is accreditation education level, because it turns out that software developers, engineers and programmers, they don't need accreditation in any way. Anybody can produce software and sell it without any accreditation.